Hi, I'm April Fulton.
And I'm Rebecca Davis. Welcome to Your Health, a weekly podcast from the Science Desk here at NPR. This week, from one disaster to another, it seems residents of the Gulf Coast states can't catch a break. We'll take a look at what hard times could be doing to their mental health.
And being overweight, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're unhealthy.
We'll also hear about the latest evidence that a popular diabetes drug known as Avandia can increase your risk of heart attack and stroke.
And how the economy is hurting those who rely on government assistance to pay for AIDS drugs.
But first, have you ever had a sudden bitter metallic taste on your tongue? You might have a case of pine mouth. Allison Aubrey has more on this strange food phenomenon.
Cecily Wilhelmi thought there might be something off about the blueberries she ate for breakfast last Tuesday morning. She perceived a strong metallic taste that lingered all the way from her breakfast table through her commute to work in suburban Seattle. At the office, after she'd made it through lunch, she realized nothing tasted normal.
Everything else that I ate tasted bitter and metallic, and my mouth tasted that way as well.
So while Cecily got on the phone to report her symptoms to her doctor, her colleague did a quick online search, typing in the terms metallic or bitter taste. When he got several hits on pine mouth, his first question to Cecily?
He said, "Have you had pine nuts?" And I looked at him as if, "Are you kidding me? I happen to have had pine nuts, but what does that have to do with anything?"
Cecily couldn't believe that a handful of toasted pine nuts that she'd eaten 2 days before could be responsible for the vile taste. The internet, after all, can lead us to all sorts of speculations, especially when we try medical sleuthing. But one item caught her attention. It was an abstract of a scientific paper in the Journal of Medical Toxicology titled "Pine Mouth Syndrome, an Emerging Problem." The author is an emergency medicine physician at the University of New Mexico. His name is Dr. Mark David Monk.
I've had it myself, which is actually what prompted my interest in it.
He came down with the bitter taste after eating pine nuts from a restaurant salad bar last year. It lasted about a week, and he didn't have any accompanying sickness. But as he tried to research the condition, he was surprised by all the anecdotal chatter about pine mouth on websites, from the U.S. to Australia and the United Kingdom. After an initial report from a Belgian doctor in 2001, the topic seemed to explode in mid-2009.
The search volume has been incredibly high, so just using that as a surrogate, we suspect that there's a lot of pine mouth in the country.
Official numbers are hard to come by. The Food and Drug Administration logged 53 complaints last year. Updated numbers are not available. Of the initial reports, two people complained of GI tract illnesses along with the bitter taste. The others, an FDA spokesperson told me, were just considered taste disturbances, not illnesses. No one knows what's causing the syndrome. For now, physician Mark David Monk says there are two theories. One is simply that people don't store pine nuts properly, and they go bad.
We know from the agricultural research that pine nut oil is particularly unstable. Some oils tend to do pretty well over long-term storage, and other oils go rancid fairly quickly, and pine nut oil is one of those that goes rancid quickly.
So this may explain some cases. The other theory implicates Chinese pine nuts. Researchers in Switzerland recently did a chemical analysis of imported pine nuts and identified two species that have not traditionally been part of the food supply.
One was the Chinese white pine and one was the Chinese red pine. These are nuts that have never historically been eaten before. The second theory is that, in fact, pine nut mouth is actually caused by generally inedible species of pine nut that have now made it onto the market.
The FDA says whenever possible, samples of pine nuts linked to cases of pine mouth should be sent to an FDA lab for testing. But so far, there's no evidence to confirm whether Chinese imports or pine nuts gone rancid may be responsible. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
You can be overweight and still be fit. Remember, muscle weighs more than fat. Health experts say the definition of a healthy weight needs to be just a little bit expanded. Patty Naiman has this report.
The treadmills are in use, and so are the bikes. But this isn't your ordinary gym. This is a cardiac rehab gym at Cedars-Sinai Heart Institute, where cardiologist Noelle Barry-Murs directs preventive care.
I'm Dr. Murs. I'm the cardiologist here. Yep, here's the face to go with all the signatures.
Barry-Murs watches a gray-haired man walking briskly on the treadmill.
I do this between 25 and 30 minutes. I go at 3.6 miles an hour, distance over 1.5 miles.
This patient isn't at all obese, but he says he is overweight, and he's working on it. Barry Merce tells me he's doing exactly the right thing for his health.
So we just saw a tremendously fine example of fitness at 82. Did I hear 82?
83.
83. We might agree that he's overweight, but he is very fit. So his overweightness at this point is not likely doing him any harm. And if anything, should he become ill and need a hospitalization, this modest overweight might actually be okay.
That's because there's some evidence that being overweight is actually protective when people get sick.
Fat is our energy storage device. It's in a way a little bit like having something in the bank.
In one study, older people who had a few extra pounds were less likely to die than their more lean counterparts. And even in midlife, being moderately overweight may not be a bad thing, says Barry Merce, as long as people are fit. And that means that heart, lungs, muscles are all working efficiently.
These would be people that, you know, could walk 30 to 60 minutes without having to stop. These are people that can climb 2 flights of stairs without becoming winded. These are people that could do some mild to moderate aerobic activity, brisk walk, jog, something like that.
Barry Merce is also doing a study of women's heart health. Recent findings show overweight women who were physically active had fewer heart problems than inactive women. In fact, being active was more important than being moderately overweight when it comes to heart disease. Women who don't exercise lack what Barry Merce calls cardiovascular reserve.
Everything is fine at rest. But then when they actually have to do something, they get winded. When they are faced with any kind of cardiovascular stressor, a car accident, a heart attack, pneumonia, they do not have a fitness level that is going to help them do well and survive.
But is an extra 10 pounds always okay as long as you're exercising? Health experts say not necessarily. When metabolism slows down at around age 50, men tend to gain weight in the abdomen while women tend to gain weight in their hips and thighs. And it turns out one is more dangerous than the other. Abdominal fat is worse than fat elsewhere in the body. Geriatrician Arun Karlamangla at UCLA recently analyzed the health status of more than 4,000 men and women nationwide.
In older people, more than just waist size alone, more than body mass index, the biggest predictor of who's going to die first was waist to hip size, the ratio of waist size to hip size. People with higher waist-hip ratios died faster, and this was true in both men and women.
Here's how Karlamangla says you can judge how you're doing. If you're a man and your waist is bigger than your hips, your risk of death is increased by 75%. For women, risk goes up gradually with every inch of increased waist size. Researchers don't know exactly why this is, but speculate abdominal or visceral fat interferes with the body's ability to process sugar.
Visceral fat increases insulin resistance, which increases the levels of insulin floating around in the body, which increases the amount of glucose in the body, which eventually leads to diabetes, and diabetes increases your risk for heart attacks and strokes.
So to keep abdominal fat down and to maintain or build fitness, the federal government recommends 30 minutes of moderate exercise every day. If you want to lose weight, you have to exercise at least 60 minutes a day. Patty Neiman, NPR News.
Some people struggling with weight can develop health problems, such as diabetes. The Food and Drug Administration approved the drug Avandia in 1999 to help control the symptoms of diabetes, and it's now the number one diabetes drug in the world. But a growing body of evidence shows that Avandia is likely to increase your risk of heart attack and stroke. Joanne Silberner talked with All Things Considered host Melissa Block about whether the new information is enough to convince the FDA to pull the drug off the market.
Joanne, lots of questions now going back several years. Why is Avandia still on the market?
Well, it is good at controlling blood sugar. That's what the company developed it for, and that's what the FDA approved it to do, and it does do that well.
But tell us more about these heart problems now that these studies are showing.
Well, they're getting to look more and more real. I mean, this all started back in 2007 when Steve Nissen from the Cleveland Clinic took a look at some data on the drug. It looked to him like there could be some heart problems going on, and he did a study, and an advisory committee to the Food and Drug Administration looked at that study and some other data and said the drug does, in fact, cause heart problems, but they suggested back then to leave it on the market. They didn't think the evidence was strong enough or that the problem was big enough. Now, though, there's a lot more data coming in. There was a study just last week of 227,000 people, and all these new studies are starting to really build up.
And if I'm somebody with type 2 diabetes taking Avandia, how concerned should I be right now?
Well, there seems to be a real risk. I think the easiest way to think about it is David Graham, Food and Drug Administration staffer, did it, and he was the one who did the analysis of the 227,000 people on the drug. And the way he puts it is this. He says, for every 60 people on the drug for a year, there's going to be one extra case of heart attack or stroke or heart failure or death. And that's a pretty high number. Now, I've got to say here, though, that the manufacturer, GlaxoSmithKline, is saying its analysis of some of the same data, plus six studies it's really focused in on, that looking at those two things, they say there is not any increased risk of heart attack, stroke, or death.
Well, how do you explain that, Joanne? How can there be such wildly disparate results in these studies?
The FDA staffers analyzing the data took a look at why there could be different interpretations, and they looked at specifically at the company's interpretation. And they're accusing the drug company of using incomplete data and using studies that weren't done all that well, where people were sort of lost to follow-up, where people stopped taking the drug after a short period of time. And there are other issues when you look at statistics. You know, how long did the studies last? What really counted? Did it have to be a heart attack that was directly observed or really proven, or could it be a suspected heart attack? You know, what counted? When the FDA looked, they saw things that counted and looked real. They saw more things than the drug company did. It's really tough to tease these things apart, and that's why the Food and Drug Administration has asked this outside committee of experts to come in and come to some sort of conclusion.
And if their conclusion is that, in fact, Avandia should come off the market, what will people who've been taking that drug do?
Well, the FDA has to decide whether to follow the advice of the committee. It held that hearing back in 2007, and that committee didn't say it should come off the market. If this committee says that it does, there's actually another drug out there. It's in the same class as Avandia, a very similar drug, and there's no direct head-to-head comparisons of these two drugs, but indirect comparisons suggest that the second drug, it's called Actos, it's also a popular drug, that drug does not cause the same level of problems as Avandia does.
Okay, Joanne Silberner speaking with us from Atlanta. Joanne, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can find out more about Avandia, including a timeline of the drug's troubled history, on our health blog, Shots, at npr.org/shots. More big news this week. The federal government announced it would boost AIDS assistance funding by $25 million. But that's just a drop in the bucket compared to the needs. The waiting list grows for patients who need help paying for the medicines as people have lost jobs and insurance during the recession. NPR's Brenda Wilson has this report.
A month ago, Florida didn't have a waiting list for ADAP, as the AIDS Drug Assistance Program is called. Now there are more than 500 people waiting for help in paying for medications. Tom Liberte, the director of the state's AIDS program, saw the line forming long before it got to this point.
Over the last several months, in the latter parts of this recession, we have been averaging over 350 patients a month coming forward for assistance.
There are about 1.5 million unemployed in the state, adding to an already large uninsured population of more than 3 million. The economic crunch, Liberte notes, has occurred in the middle of a federal government push for states to test millions of people for HIV and get people into treatment early.
So if you saw a picture of this, you would see that the demand and the number of patients coming forward has gone up dramatically, but the funding that pays for the pharmaceuticals and the drugs did not.
ADAP provides assistance for nearly 170,000 people nationwide who can't afford the expensive AIDS drugs, even on a working person's salary. The drugs can mean surviving many years and leading a productive life. Federal and state ADAP budgets are determined on a year-to-year basis and haven't changed recently. More than 2,000 people in 12 states are now on waiting list, and just as many states have tightened requirements for those they will assist. None of this was on 46-year-old Mike Demery's mind in December, when he moved to Victor, Montana from Portland, Oregon. Back in Oregon, his medicines and part of his insurance premium were paid for by Oregon's ADAP.
I moved here for my mother. My mother has a lot of health problems, and I didn't do much investigating as far as what they had as far as plans for medication, plans for medical treatment, et cetera, et cetera.
First, there was a month-long wait to see a doctor.
By the time I got in to see the doctor, I had been without my medications for a month and a half, which is bad for somebody on HIV.
During that time, the virus started coming back, but he had to get in line behind 18 people who were on a list that he has slowly, month by month, been working his way to the top of. Luckily, he still had a one-month refill back at the pharmacy in Oregon that was sent to him by mail, and a case manager in Montana helped him apply for free drugs from pharmaceutical companies through the patient's assistance programs that most have.
So that's three application forms, because each one of my medications are manufactured by a different manufacturer.
And every 90 days, he has to reapply for assistance to each of these companies. Waiting lists for ADAP aren't new. It's been running over budget since a decade after its inception, but never have the lines been this long. Murray Penner of the National Association of State and Territorial AIDS Directors says it's not just the economy.
The other factor driving that is just more people living longer, which is the obvious, and we know that's a good thing over time, but it's something that has been coming over a long period of time since all the new treatments have come into play.
In the past, federal and state governments have come up with the emergency assistance, but this time, Penner says Congress has failed to respond to an appeal from the states for $126 million.
Everybody is supportive. I mean, we've got letters with lots of sign-ons from, you know, representatives and senators that's saying, sure, we want more money, but nobody's willing to stick their neck out and actually put more money towards the issue.
So state AIDS directors like Florida's Tom Liberte say they're just hanging on until the next fiscal year.
We don't want people to panic. We don't want people to make wrong decisions about getting tested or coming forward. I do believe that if the economy gets better and some additional federal resources come through, that we can get by this. Just it's unclear on how long.
Under the new health care law, most of these people would be eligible for treatment, but that won't kick in for another 4 years. Brenda Wilson, NPR News.
And finally, we leave you with the inspiring story of an African dentist who died this week at age 90. Dr. Robert Lee, a dentist from South Carolina, escaped racism in the 1950s by going to Ghana. He became a fixture in the country. Tell Me More's Michelle Martin talks to NPR West African correspondent Ophabia Quist Arkton about his life and legacy.
Always a pleasure. Oh, Dr. Lee. Dr. Lee, as everybody called him in Ghana. He was a figure that everybody knew, with his gray hair, his baritone voice, his gentle manner, and his passion for Ghana. It's going to be a huge, 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 huge loss, Michelle.
Fabio, back up for a second and tell us why Dr. Lee moved to Ghana to begin with. And I have to tell you, one of the reasons I was so intrigued by this is I, too, have a relative who moved to Ghana in the 1950s, but who did come back about a decade later. So, and I've never had a chance to ask him why he did that. So would you tell us why Dr. Lee moved to Ghana?
You know what? He said he met Kwame Nkrumah, Ghana's independence leader, the first prime minister and then president of Ghana, at Lincoln University, and other Ghanaians. He said they just lit a fire in him. Whilst America was trying to deal with its human rights and its civil rights problem, he said here were these young Africans, and they were so confident that they were going to be able to jettison colonial rule, and they were so sure, so determined, that he was fired up by them, and that's why he wanted to be there to witness it. He said not that he was against or not that he'd given up on civil rights in the U.S., but he was so galvanized by the Ghanaians, or the Gold Coasters as they were called there, that he was going to head to Ghana with them.
You mentioned that he made a life for himself. He trained Ghanaians in dentistry, and he became a leader, some would say a part of the patriarchy of the African-American expatriate community there. What was it that made him so beloved?
I think it's because Dr. Lee was such a listener. And it wasn't only Dr. Lee who trained the generation of Ghanaians, his wife as well. I mean, this was a couple that came to Ghana and that helped Ghana. I remember Dr. Lee telling me, because I never met his late wife, that she set up the first mobile clinic and that it used to travel around the capital, Accra, and help people who had problems with their teeth and their health. I mean, that was unheard of then. Ghana had just got independence. Did we have any dentists? Probably very few. Doctors? Probably very few at that point. But these two people, this couple, come all the way from the U.S. to say, Ghana, we're here to help you. We're here to live with you. We're here to become a part of you. I mean, that's just such a wonderful story.
Let me ask you, though. You interviewed Dr. Lee in the course of President Obama's brief visit to Ghana last year. And I wonder, did Dr. Lee ever express any regret that he... Well, he certainly did leave to see the day when the United States had an African-American president. But did he express any regret that he'd missed out being in the country, in the U.S., when all this was happening?
I think I asked him about what was going on in the U.S. He said, you know, he goes home, he went home for medical treatment, he's a war vet and so on. He hadn't cut off from the U.S., not at all. Some of his children are there, brought up there. But what he felt, though, with Barack Obama being elected the first black president of the U.S., is that the U.S. was also making progress. But I think he also felt that, in a way, Ghana had made progress long before the U.S. The fact that the independence leaders had fought for their struggle, gone to prison for their struggle, and been determined to say to Britain, enough, we are ready to govern ourselves, that he felt was a tremendous achievement.
Let's just play a short clip from your interview with Dr. Lee, where you asked him about what he thought President Obama's election represents. Here it is.
This fellow also shows that your being black doesn't have much to do with what you become. Because Africans in the past, in America and in Africa, always felt that they can never do these things. These were supposed to serve for white people. But that Obama has proved this is not true.
So, Afibia, you found him quite charming, it seems.
Not quite charming. Unbelievably charming. He had one of these brilliant smiles that lit up his whole face. You go into his living room, and it's the history of my country, Ghana, 50-plus years. He has photographs. He has newspaper cuttings. He had just everything that was proof that he had lived through the history of my country. I was born just after independence. Ghana gained its independence in 57. I was born in 58. And yet here is this African-American, Henri Ghanaian, telling me about my country's history. He was truly, truly a man I salute. We say, Dr. Lee, yedamwasi. Thank you. Thank you for coming to Ghana. Thank you for believing in Ghanaians. And thank you for staying in Ghana and living through the good and the bad times with you. Yedamwasi.
And finally, he still retained his affection for the United States. When you interviewed him last year, you asked him if he might wish to sing a song for President Obama, and this is what he told you. Here it is.
He would probably want to sing like, God bless America, land that I love, stand beside her and guide her. Like that, a song like that. From the mountains to the prairie to the ocean, white with foam, God bless America, my home, sweet home.
That was Dr. Robert Lee, a leader in the African-American community in Ghana. He moved to the country in the mid-1950s from South Carolina. He died on Monday, July 5th, at the age of 90. And that was him being interviewed by our own Afibia Quist-Arkton, NPR's West Africa correspondent, and she was kind enough to join us to tell us about his life and influence. Afibia, thank you so much for bringing us this lovely story.
Dr. Lee Daye, rest in perfect peace. You deserve it. Thank you, Michelle.
And that's all for Your Health. We'll be back again next week. I'm April Fulton.
And I'm Rebecca Davis. Thanks for listening.